The Only Crime.
So, short steel in my left hand? Asked Savine. Yes, then your front foot at the mark. This mark?
She worked her shoe into the chalk line on the palace lawn, as though she had never seen one before.
How exciting! Isn't it?
Durand was teetering on the edge of impatience as he stepped to his own mark, weighing his steels. Then, when I say begin, she darted at him with no warning and no mercy, the way her father taught her. Durand was a skilled swordsman. No doubt he was quicker and far stronger than her, and it was a while since she had held a steel. She could never have beaten him in a fair bout, but who wants to fight those? His long steel was not even up when she caught it with hers, blade flickering, metal scraping, jerking it from his unready hand. She stepped sharply around him as he stumbled, planting her heel behind his where it could trip him. He made a soft oof as her shoulder thudded into his breastbone and sent him crashing onto his back, his short steel bouncing away across the well-tended grass. His expression of total shock as the blunted point of her long steel tickled him under the chin was positively delightful.
"Would that be a touch to me?" she asked, all innocence.
He slowly lifted his head.
"I have a strange sense you fenced before." "I never said otherwise."
She stabbed her long steel into the turf and offered him her hand.
"That was your assumption. You could have corrected me," he said as she helped him up. "I just did. I've been fencing since I was a girl. My father taught me."
He bent to collect his steels.
"So, not only have you fenced before, but you were trained by one of the best swordsmen the Union ever produced."
She gave an artless shrug.
"It's fine exercise."
The moment he was up, she came at him again, but this time he was ready, parried, and stepped watchfully back towards the edge of the circle.
"I expected to be giving a lesson," he muttered. "I should have realized I'd be taking one." "Not at all. I gave up playing with knives after Valbec."
The well-worn memory of her sword sliding through that man's back, the faint pressure of the grip in her palm, the look of shock on his face. But she found she could dismiss it much more easily now. She had warned him, after all. If he had not wanted to be stabbed, he should have fucking left her alone.
"Pregnancy and motherhood are hardly compatible with the fencing circle. I am awfully out of practice." "That was my first thought just now as I lay on my back with your sword at my throat. How awfully out of practice you seem."
He jabbed warily at her and she flicked it away. Her legs felt heavier than they once had, her breath came harder, but it felt good to be back in the circle. She had spent too long curled up with her babies, growing soft and motherly. It was high time that she exerted some discipline, that she competed, that she won, and not just with a sword.
"I confess I was not looking only for a fencing partner," she said.
"An ulterior motive?" Durand eyed her steels warily as they circled.
"You shock me again. I wanted to talk to you about the future."
"To me?"
"To you, first of all."
She danced in, their blades rang together prettily enough, but with no real fire, and they broke again.
"The new closed council must represent the new union, and you will be its heart. You should be confirmed as Lord Chamberlain."
Durand looked pleased, flattered, and slightly flushed, precisely as she had intended.
"I would be honoured to serve your highnesses however you decide."
"Please, I need you at that table every bit as much as Leo does. You are a clever man, Durand, subtle and loyal. You have a gift for organisation. I wish you had been at Stauffenbeck with us. I begged Leo to bring you, but, well..."
She jabbed again and again, left her wrist limp and let him parry easily.
Nowhere near as sharply as she could have done, nowhere near as sharply as her father once made her, again and again, until her whole body was on fire.
"Glaward must have a seat too, of course, as Lord Marshal, maybe."
"I think that is what Leo had in mind."
And perhaps he was thinking of, say, Isher as Lord Chancellor and Huygen as Lord Admiral?
Durin's forehead wrinkled in surprise.
That's exactly what he was thinking.
Then it seems sensible to fill the arch-lectors and high consul's chairs with seasoned bureaucrats, people who understand the challenges of reform and can bring a weight of experience with them.
That does seem sensible.
Ah! She made him twist away from a quick cut and trot back into space, shaking his head.
I am of the firm opinion, however,
cut, cut, jab,
that it would be a missed opportunity to return to the way things were in King Jazal's reign,
jab, jab, cut,
a regime that ensured its own downfall with its waste and exploitation and callous disregard for its subjects.
Steel rang with each word.
We need a new kind of person on the closed council. Engineers and architects, investors and inventors.
Durin came back at her and she parried once, twice, thrice.
People who understand the tools of the new age.
Jab, jab, jab.
Who can help us build a better union.
I don't know. Leo can be quite traditional in his...
We must move on, Durand, and we must bring the people with us. After all that was lost in the Great Change, all that was destroyed.
She thought of Vic Dan Teufel then, of all people, that oddly moving moment of unexpected honesty beneath the House of Questions. She lowered her steels and looked Durand in the eye.
It can't all be for nothing, you understand?
He blinked, then swallowed, and his own steels slowly drifted down.
I do.
Savine shook herself.
Shall we break?
Durand was starting to get her measure, and that would never do.
There was a time I could keep fencing for hours, but motherhood changes you in so many ways.
Oh, of course. You are Leo's oldest friend, she said, with a wrong-footing change of subject.
His best friend.
One should never let an opponent get comfortable in a conversation, after all, any more than in fencing or business or politics.
And you are a perceptive man. You must know that he and I are not entirely getting along.
She let him see her pain at that, her regret.
But we simply must remain friends for the sake of our children, for the sake of the nation. I have always felt one cannot have too many friends.
She came closer, looking up shyly from under her lashes.
Are we friends, Durand?
He was caught between sympathy and mistrust.
I would like us to be. I mean, I like to think we are.
I cannot tell you what a comfort that is. She rested a gentle hand on his forearm. A little human contact, carefully administered, can have such a powerful effect.
To know that even if I have made a mess of things with Leo, we will always have a good friend in common.
I don't want to deceive you. I have to be Leo's friend first.
Of course. I should have been a better friend to him myself. I know it was a fool's mistake to let Orso go, but I allowed my heart to overcome my head for once. He is my brother, after all. I have...
She had to swallow the emotion not entirely feigned.
Complicated feelings about him.
She had thought this might be where Durand grew suspicious, but for some reason he looked nervous instead. Was there even pity in his eyes? As if he had some secret on the tip of his tongue, but in the end he swallowed it.
Perhaps you should tell Leo that. I'm sure he'd like to hear it.
Savine would sooner have set herself on fire than apologize for saving Orso's life. She passed it off with an emotional sniff.
I fear Leo will not listen to me any more. For good reasons, I know. But he will listen to you.
I agree with you about the closed council and about changing the union for the better. I agree with you about a lot of things. But Leo,
please, Durand.
She did not let her lower lip actually wobble or her eyes fill with tears. That would have been sugaring the pudding too much.
but she let her voice crack ever so slightly. Durand was a caretaker, a fixer of problems, happiest when he was needed. So she let herself be needy. "I need your help. We all do." She gave his forearm a gentle squeeze. "For my sake and his." She looked up earnestly into his face. "For the sake of our children." She left herself defenseless. "For the sake of the nation. Can I be entirely honest with you? Can I lay myself bare?" He hardly knew what to say to that. I think we are alike in many ways. I can be quite perceptive, too." She eased even closer, squeezed his arm tighter, made her voice softer, so he had to lean down towards her. "I have started to believe that Leo," she fixed him with her eye and whispered the words, "is in love with someone else. That he always has been. I have often thought about how he reacted to what happened in Sapani." Juran's cheek flushed. He tried to pull away, but she gripped his arm. "I have come to believe it might not have been disgust at all, but jealousy." There was a long, tense silence while Durand stared at her, and the birds twittered pleasantly in the budding trees, and the bees buzzed about a patch of fragrant lavender, and somewhere from a high window in the wall of the palace, a maid sang in a fine, high voice as she beat the curtains. "I doubt he would admit it to anyone," murmured Savine. "I doubt he even admits it to himself. But if he ever did, I want you to know I would be the last person to stand in the way of his happiness." Even softer, so softly it was just breath, she added the last two words, "or yours." Juran's throat made a distinct squelching sound as he swallowed, the knob on his neck bobbing. "I hardly know what you can mean." She held his eye a moment longer, until she was satisfied that neither one of them could have any doubts exactly what she meant. Then, with a final squeeze, she let him go and took up her steels again, all business. "I can only apologize. I have wandered so far from the subject. Women, we simply cannot resist discussing affairs of the heart when they come up. We were talking about the composition of the new closed council, I think." Durand cleared his throat with some difficulty. Yes. Were there any names in particular? You...
Kernsbeck, Court, Valamir, and Celeste Ann Huygen." He blinked.
"You have given this some thought. I hate to have my time wasted with ill-considered proposals, don't you? I promise there is excellent sense in every one of those names. Forward-looking people, each with fine qualities. Properly led, with Leo's charisma and your prudent oversight, they will be invaluable servants of the crown." "Well," his mind was clearly elsewhere as he took his mark, "I suppose I can talk to Leo."
"That's all I ask. When do we begin?"
"Whenever you..." This time she came at him with even less warning, snapping the jabs out in a lethal flurry that would have made even her father applaud. Juran managed to stumble back from the first, just about parried the second, but the last three thudded into his padded jacket in about the same spot, rocking him back on his heels, then sending him stumbling from the circle.
"Oh," said Savine, "I suppose that would be another touch to me."
Juran winced as he rubbed at the dent in his jacket.
"Is there anything you do badly?"
"Lose."
She gave her sweetest smile.
"I swear I'm the worst loser in the world."
When Savine walked into the gilded immensity of the Lord and Lady Regent's great chamber, Zuri was sitting in a pool of lamplight working at the book.
"How was the sword play, Your Highness?"
she asked, setting down her pencil.
"You don't need to highness me, Zuri, not when there's no one else here."
Zuri arched one black brow.
My chicken, then? My pigeon? My dove? How about Savine?
Then how was the sword play, Savine?
She rubbed at the sore patch the long steel's grip had left down the side of her little finger.
I am rather rusty, but will soon polish up, and I think I was able to tickle young Lord Durand where he is most ticklish. I never doubted it.
She caught Savine's eye, that brow creeping higher. It only remains to be seen whether he can tickle your husband half so deftly.
Zuri, you're a devil. I dare say my scripture teacher would be deeply disappointed in me.
You sound rather pleased at the prospect. I believe I am. How are the designs?
Savine crossed tiles already scored with scratches from Leo's mechanical foot and tossed the sheaf of plans on a side table under the ever-disapproving painted eye of Lord Marshal Croy.
There were some awful ones. We could have a triangular Lord's Round, apparently, or one that looks like a wedding cake. She slipped the box from her sleeve and took a little pinch of pearl dust, just to keep things afloat. But there were some good ideas. She stifled a sneeze.
And they're already clearing the site. Within 10 years, the Union will have a new heart, bigger and better than ever.
Progress, then.
Zuri permitted herself a little smile.
Whoever would have thought the Union would have a big heart?
How are the children?
Asked Savine, stepping towards the tall door to the nursery, decorated with the Son of the Union in gold leaf.
They are well, but...
Zuri put a gentle hand on Savine's arm.
You should know they have a visitor.
And she eased the door open. Savine's mother stood beside the cots, rocking her tiny namesake with practiced carelessness, pulling faces while the baby gurgled happily.
Savine, she said, prancing over. It's so good to see you.
Quite as if they were an ordinary mother and daughter, and it had been an ordinary few days since they last spoke, rather than 6 terrifying months in which Savine had nearly died, given birth, nearly died again, then taken control of a nation. She leaned forwards to kiss Savine's cheek and gave her a noseful of that familiar, heady mix of perfume and alcohol. The smell of her childhood, the smell of being cared for in an offhand, slightly lazy way. Savine felt herself caught on uncertain ground between fury at being abandoned and sappy relief that her mother was alive and had danced into her life again.
You look well,
she managed to say, sickening banality considering. But her mother did look very well, as if she had been on a well-earned holiday these past few months somewhere sunny, while Adua shivered through the bitterest winter on record in more ways than one.
All the better for seeing these little darlings of yours. By the fates, Leo is a fine-looking man, but these children are positively beautiful.
She leaned over Harrod's cot, the monstrous diamond on her wedding band flashing as she waggled a finger at its occupant, speaking in a baby voice Savine found intensely enraging.
Aren't you, you little beauties, so very beautiful?
Mother?
Yes?
Are you really going to fuss over my children as if nothing has happened?
Honestly, I was rather hoping to.
Savine kept her voice under control with some difficulty.
For 6 months, while the world was burning down around us, I've had no idea where you were. Not a letter. Not a word, not a whisper.
I know, I know.
She seemed almost a little impatient.
And I'm so sorry.
You don't sound it.
But you can understand we had to keep our heads down. Savine, please, I'm not the enemy. What are you exactly?
She sank into a chair with a rustling of expensive skirts, sitting Harrod on her knee so she could look deep into his eyes.
I still feel very much like the same sarcastic drunk I was at 17. But now I'm a grandmother, apparently. And to a king, would you believe? Let's not pretend this is the first time you've had a future monarch in your lap. Really, that would have been beneath you at 12,
It's certainly beneath you now you're the Lady Regent of the Union.
She was right, of course, but that did not help, of course.
You can't just turn up, Mother. Isn't that what grandmothers do? Avoid all the work, then whisk in for the glory? It's safe now, isn't it?
Of course, but it wasn't safe before.
I am aware. I was thinking very much the same thing while I sat in the midst of at least two different riots, then in prison, then in the dock. Your father and I sitting there with you would only have made things worse.
Harrod gave an annoyed burble, and Savine's mother softened her exasperated tone.
I wanted to be there to help you through it all. When the babies were born, of course I wanted nothing more. But I knew all I could do was to put you in more danger, and I knew you'd make it through. You've always been such a fighter, such a modern can-do woman. You really are so like your father. The pair of you simply refuse to be beaten.
He isn't my father, grumbled Savine, but it sounded churlish. How the hell could she have come out of this as the unreasonable one?
Whether you like it or not, he's your father in every way that counts. Then where was he?
It's better that he explains it himself.
He's here. I think he wanted me to talk to you first, break the ice. You know how it is, Savine. Married couples tend to specialise, and I've always done the small talk, while he was more interested in
the torture.
I was going to say the long-term planning, but no doubt you'll have it your way. You always have.
Savine pronounced every word with angry precision.
Believe me when I say that I have not.
Where is he? Her mother nodded towards an unused door.
Can I stay with them for a while?
Savine wanted to say no, but she had never known how to say no to her mother, and Harrod was clinging to her finger so tightly, the bloody little traitor. It would only have been punishing the children, and everything was supposed to be about them now. Having a child limits one's choices. Two at once is an even worse constriction. Make one of them a king, and you lose all say in anything.
Savine gave a hopeless shrug. Since you're here.
She turned the key in the door and stepped through. She had never found out why they called it the sighing room. Perhaps some royal widow had worn her life away in endless mourning there. It had three doors, one to the nursery, one to their great chamber, and one out into the hallway. The walls had been scrubbed clean of the breakers' slogans and freshly whitewashed, but Savine had not got as far as decorating. In any reasonable house, it would have been a grand salon. In the palace, it was one step above a cupboard. But it had a fine, high-vaulted ceiling and a stone floor polished by the passage of centuries of servants' feet, and a beautiful window. There was excellent light in the mornings, so Leo had requisitioned the place for Carmi Groom to paint his portrait. In the evenings, though, it was quiet and dim and full of shadows. Savine's father, in every way that counted, sat in that wheeled chair Kernsbeck had designed for him, knees making two knobbles in the blanket across his withered legs, frowning at the unfinished canvas. The young lion bursting through the city gates astride a sable charger to deliver the nation from chaos, sending as yet roughly sketched traitors routing for their cowardly lives. Savine walked to him, skirts hissing on stone in the heavy silence. All the way her mouth was open to speak, but when she got to the chair she still had not found the words. In the end, she simply put her hand on her father's bony shoulder, the way she might have years ago. He laid his hand on top of hers. They looked up at the half-finished painting of Leo embodying the manly virtues, his iron leg hidden by horseflesh and his ruined arm by gold braid, pointing his sword towards a better tomorrow.
"I think it will be a fine portrait," said her father. "Somewhat overwrought and sentimental, but so is its subject. It's also an absolute pack of lies."
He gave a sigh.
But if people wanted the truth, they could look at the real world. In my experience, they much prefer paintings.
Paintings are less likely to kill you.
There is that. Where is the Lord Regent himself, delivering the nation from peril once again?
Overseeing the organization of his new army.
Someone's compensating for something. But I suppose a warrior must have a sword.
I understand they're calling it the Regent's Own.
That could apply as much to the Lady Regent as the Lord.
Savine's father glanced up at her.
I always thought armour would suit you rather well.
Difficult to nurse in a breastplate, and toy soldiers were never my playthings as a girl.
Neither were dolls. As I recall, it was fencing, money, and power from the time you could talk, which was precociously early.
Did it ever occur to you that those things interested me because they interested you?
Who cares where they came from? They're fine interests to have.
His grin became a grimace as he clawed at one of the wheels of his chair, turning it towards her.
I have to tell you how impressed I am, Savine. You not only plotted a safe path through this madness, but made yourself exceedingly popular in the process. Quite the feat for a woman who once put so much effort into making herself unpopular.
I can do without your flattery, she lied. Honestly, his approval was still a headier drug than pearl dust to her. No one knew her better than he did. No one understood her so well. Except Orso, perhaps, and he was gone. He took her hand in both of his, frowning down at it.
You have no idea how hard it has been to know you were in danger. But with your marriage and the choices you made afterwards, you put yourself beyond my reach. I hope you can understand that I was always doing my best to help you in my own way. Someone had to have an eye on the bigger picture. I was working with Superior Pike to bring this madness to an end.
A cold sliver of doubt pierced the warm fuzz of their reunion and began to stab deeper.
Working with Pike? Wasn't he behind all this? No, Savine. The time has come for me, at long last, to confess.
His eyes slid up to hers, bright in their bruised sockets. There was no remorse in them. If anything, he had a kind of stubborn pride as he said the words,
I was.
Her hand was prickling where he held it.
What do you mean? When I was a young man and widely admired, there actually was the time, if you can believe it, I always imagined the power was in the closed council. But from the moment I first perched my withered arse on a chair there, it was clear we were all puppets. Baez pulled the strings and always had. He controlled the banks, and their roots ate into everything. A web of debts and secrets and favours deeper than you can imagine. Valentin Balk.
His eyelid flickered, and he dabbed a streak of wet from his weepy eye with a knuckle.
They were like ivy choking the garden. King Jazal and I, you might not believe it, but we tried to do some good. As long as Baez was there, we were helpless.
He paused, shadows black in the deep lines of his frowning face.
I had to bring a great change.
Savine could only stare at him, while the floor seemed to shift under her feet, seemed to shift so savagely it was hard almost to keep her balance.
You brought the great change? I had to burn out the corruption, rip Baez and his bank up by the roots, dig it all over so we could plant something new, something good.
He sat forward, gripping her hand tight, lips curling back from his ruined teeth.
And now we have that chance. Don't talk to me about fucking gardening, she screamed, tearing her hands from his. People died, thousands of them. She felt dizzy, she felt sick. I nearly died, more than once. He gave a frustrated twitch, as if the problem was not his epic ruthlessness, but her poor temper.
Progress does not come without sacrifices. You have always seen that more clearly than anyone. The court of the people was not at all what we had in mind, but once it became clear what a disaster Rizenau would be, Judge was the only option. Who could have known Judge would be even worse?
Anyone who saw what she did in Valbek, anyone with eyes or ears in their head. The woman was fucking insane.
A period of insanity was necessary so that sanity could prevail, grumbled her father, as if she was complaining about footprints on a rug. I would have liked a more orderly transition, but Baez began to show an interest in you, and I could not risk that. Honestly, Savine, a little gratitude would not kill you.
Gratitude, she whispered.
I did it all for you, so you could truly rule. All your life, we've been preparing you for this.
My mother knew what you were planning?
It was her idea in the first place, one of her best.
Savine did not often find herself at a loss for words. She slowly stepped back, pointing at her father with a trembling hand.
Because I was King Giselle's bastard. You knew all along. If Orso could be removed, I could be put in his place.
Your parentage was not a choice we made.
Only something you turned to your advantage.
To everyone's advantage, he barked,
wheeling himself towards her.
Put aside your pique, Savine. This was war. In war, one must make use of every weapon. Restraint is folly. Worse, restraint is cowardice. You can give us a better union, a better world. The horrors of the Great Change have left people pliable, desperate for strong leadership. You are loved as much as I was hated, and the banks are torn up by the roots. We will finally have a free hand.
We, she whispered.
Your son will be king, but he will need your guidance.
He gripped her arm, and there was strength in those thin fingers, a grasping strength.
And you will need mine.
Savine stared at him, cold all over.
You freed us from Baez.
Yes.
So you could become Baez.
He narrowed his eyes.
That is unfair.
You're right.
She twisted her arm free, taking another step back.
He only destroyed half the Agrient for his own ambitions. You destroyed half the Union.
You were willing to destroy a sizable chunk of it for the sake of your ambitions, as I recall. You and your husband's revolt against the crown nearly ruined everything.
She gave a disbelieving gasp.
Was my mistake that I spoiled your efforts to burn down the world, or that I didn't burn down enough of it?
Both, he said.
I should have denounced you in the court of the people, whispered Savine. I should have denounced you to hell.
You should have. It might have improved your situation and could not possibly have done me any harm. That is the kind of sentimental mistake I can help you avoid in future. You have a struggle ahead of you, Savine.
He gave the painting a significant glance.
Your husband may prove more difficult to control than anyone imagined. We cripples have a habit of surprising people. And freeing Orso with a blunder you may well regret. Then there are the nobles, and the commoners, and the Styrians, and the Imperials, and the Gurkish will not stay down forever.
Enemies stretching off ahead of her enough to fill a lifetime.
The time will come sooner than you think when you will need my support.
She would have loved to tell him to fuck himself. At that moment, she would have loved to punch him out of his chair. But although her eyes were narrowed and her fist clenched to do it, she did not indulge herself. Savine had taken many roles over the momentous past year or two, or had them forced upon her. A helpless fugitive, a desperate killer, a disappointed lover, a wife and a partner, a rebel and a traitor, a forger of alliances, a mother to twins, a benefactor to orphans, the wretched accused, the terrified convicted, the darling of the slums, and the mother of the nation. A journey of giddy rises, horrifying falls, and wild reverses that could leave no one the same. But above all, Savine had always been a woman of business, and a woman of business cannot afford to be a slave to her passions. She has to be realistic and plan for the long term. She must take the world as it is and look for the best deal. She raised her chin, looking at her father down her nose.
Then I suppose we should talk prices.
He showed those empty gums of his as he smiled.
That's my...
There was a crash. Outside in the gardens, Savine's father frowned towards the window. An angry cry cut off in another crash, even louder, as if something heavy had fallen from a height.
What was that?
For some reason, Savine felt the need to whisper. Her father held up a hand, eyes still narrowed at the window.
Stay calm. Calm? What have you done?
Freed us from Baiath. His eyes flickered sideways towards a muffled yell.
But the first of the Magi was never going to simply let us steal the Union from under his nose.
Savine heard shouting in the corridor, then a long, thin scream. She took an unsteady step away. She had been on a battlefield and knew what genuine agony sounded like. It ended in a sickening metallic crash, and another, closer. Then a crunching thud so near and so hard that Savine felt the floor vibrate. The painting rattled on its stand. Dust filtered gently down from the vaults above. Her father slowly, effortfully swiveled his chair towards the door to the hallway.
Get behind me, he said.
The knob turned and the door swung open. A face appeared around the edge. An unremarkable face with different coloured eyes.
Knock, knock.
Yoru Sulphur stepped into the room. He was neatly presented, as he had always been at meetings of the Solar Society. That same polite manner, that same unassuming smile. The only difference, that he was spattered from head to toe with blood. Savine took a quivering step back. These rooms were the best guarded in the Union. He must have come through several well-armed men. She presumed it was their screams she had heard, their gore with which he was showered. He called himself a Magus, but she had thought of it as a hollow title, left over from a distant age of ignorance and superstition. She knew that Baiaz had ruined the Agrient, but that had been before she was born. She had heard people whisper about eaters, but written it off as small-minded fear-mongering. Every day she had seen the dark outline of the House of the Maker looming over even the city's tallest chimneys, but she had somehow allowed herself to believe that actual magic would never play a role in her thoroughly structured, ruthlessly rational, entirely modern life. It was with a feeling of chill horror that she discovered her error. Sulphur smiled at her father. The smile of a disappointed tutor finally tracking down a wayward pupil.
Sand Dan Glockter, you have become a difficult man to find.
Did you try making an appointment?
You know, I prefer to arrive unannounced.
Sulphur rooted through his curly hair and picked something out between finger and thumb. A piece of bone, perhaps a tooth. He flicked it away and it bounced clicking across the floor.
I warned my master you could not be trusted. What useful people can be.
Sulphur smiled wider, showing a full set of clean, sharp teeth.
Do you know, those were his very words.
He glanced towards Savine, who was clinging to one of the handles of her father's chair, no idea whether to stand her ground, run for the children, or scream for help.
Did you really think you could stuff King Jazal's bastard onto the throne without even a by your leave? I did. I have. Doing it is one thing. Getting away with it is quite another. For a man who complains so much about pain, you have been happy to inflict it wholesale.
Sulphur gently wagged one finger as he padded across the room towards them.
All this destruction, just to end up trapped by your own cleverness. No doubt this is a trap.
Glockter looked up mildly at Sulphur,
but not for me. What will you do, cripple? Wheel your chair over me? You forget, I have some experience with your kind. The best weapon against an eater is another.
A latch dropped with a soft scrape, and Sulphur froze in the middle of the floor. Zuri had slipped in through the nursery door. Savine was about to scream at her to get out, to get help, but something stole her voice, so all that came out was a reedy squeak. Zuri's head hung over on one side, her teeth showing very white as she smiled too wide, her eyes gleaming black in the shadows.
Someone has been a very bad boy, she said.
Sulphur spun towards the door he had come in through, but Haroon had entered from the hallway and now pushed it firmly shut. Rabik dropped from the shadows among the vaults above, spun in the air as neatly as an acrobat, and landed silently on all fours. Savine had no idea how she could have failed to notice him clinging to the ceiling, but she saw him now.
"It has been a long time, Sulphur," he sang,
rocking back on his haunches.
"So much to answer for," said Haroon.
The shock on Sulphur's face only lasted for an instant. Then the air above his shoulders shimmered, and Rabik was flung across the room as if by a slap from a giant's hand. Savine gasped as he crashed into the window in a spray of glass, bounced from the stone frame, leaving a great crack. He should have been dead, every bone shattered. Instead, he fell in a ready crouch like a cat dropped from a high place, dust showering from a great dry split in his cheek, but his mouth still fixed in a smile. Sulphur and Haroon were fighting, too fast for Savine's darting eyes to follow, a tangle of flailing limbs, blows landing with thuds, and smacks so loud they were painful on the ear. Savine felt an awful sucking in her stomach, and Haroon tumbled past like a cannon stone, missed her by no more than a stride, smashed into the wall with an impact that showered plaster and made the whole room shake. Savine clung to her father's chair, a great draught nearly dragging her over as Zuri whipped by in a white blur, crossing the room in two impossible strides, springing high into the air. Sulphur was turning, mouth twisted, arm raised, when she dropped on him with a crash like a thunderclap, buckling the polished floor, shattering the polished stones, chips of rock and spots of blood flying, sending out a wash of wind that rocked the painting on its easel. There was a brilliant flash. Savine squeezed her eyes shut, but still saw the bloom of fire through her lids, felt the heat of it stinging her face. She fell on her side, a roar all about her, like a great furnace catching light. She coughed, retched, throat full of the acid tang of burning. Harun was bent over her father's chair, shielding them both with his body, hair on fire, beard on fire, shirt turning black as it burned, hanging off his arms in flaming strips. Savine tried to shield her face, but her sleeve was on fire. She dragged herself up by the arm of her father's chair, saw the blanket across his knees was burning too, ripped it from his legs, dragging him around a squealing quarter turn, beating at her sleeve with it, trying to smother the flames. Little fires were scattered across the floor, blurred and sparkling through the tears stung from her eyes. Leo's ruined painting was scorching, canvas curling, the room crazily lit by flickering flames cast into dancing shadow. Sulfur reeled and thrashed while Rabik clawed at him, bit at him. His hair turned to a burning torch. Sulfur flung him away, but Rabik tore a mouthful of meat from his face as he went, ripping one of his ears half off, tumbling across the floor, spinning, sliding, fingernails squealing as they scored long scratches in the stones. Sulfur crouched, breath coming in hisses, blood coursing from the bite marks on his face, blood dripping from his fingertips and pattering on the broken flags. He looked towards the window, but Rabik was there, his bloody tongue hanging out. He looked towards the nursery, but Harun was there, giving a rumbling growl as he slapped ash from his body. He looked towards the hallway, but Zuri was there. Her charred clothes dangled from her in tatters, and underneath her long limbs were bound in white bandages. She neatly blew out a flame still burning on her shoulder and clicked her tongue in annoyance. "This was my favourite dress," she said. Sulfur rounded on Savine and her father. She caught a glimpse of his bared teeth shining, his different coloured eyes turned black in the dying firelight. The air about his shoulders shimmered once more, and Savine took a whooping breath to scream. Zuri caught him from behind like a trap snapping shut, one arm snaking around his neck, one around his chest, legs locked tight about his hips. He caught her hair, but now Harun was on him, gripping his wrist with one broad hand, his throat with the other. Rabik skittered up, wrapping himself around Sulfur's legs, all three of them pinning him fast. Savine cowered behind her father's chair, staring between her fingers. Zuri twisted Sulfur's head back, one hand hooking his top jaw, one hooking the bottom. She snarled as she began to drag them apart, his eyes bulging, his mouth gaping wider and wider until with a snapping crunch she ripped his face wide open, blood showering, tearing his bottom jaw from his head until it hung on strings of gristle. He made a gurgling hiss as he fell, and they swarmed on him with a crunching, ripping, cracking, blood spraying the broken floor, spotting the walls. The whole impossible fight had only taken a few breaths. "Out!" Savine's father was tugging weakly at her charred sleeve. "Out!" Stupidly, she turned his chair, her shoes slithering on the smooth stones, leaving crooked tracks through the scattered ash and chips of masonry. She whimpered as she wheeled it to the door, got it caught on the frame, snarled as she wrestled it through into the great chamber, skinning her knuckles, the sound of ripping and gnawing echoing behind her. She dragged the door shut and hung from the knob. Her eyes were swimming, her legs wobbled. She could scarcely see through the smeared after-images across her vision, scarcely hear for the ringing in her ears. She stumbled, nearly fell, and someone caught her. Her mother, holding her tight, stroking her head. Savine clung to her, making a little moan with every breath.
"Don't worry, the children are safe."
"Safe," whispered Savine. Her hand was burned. The sleeve of her dress was scorched, the skin beneath tingled. Faint through the door, she could still hear them eating.
Zuri is...
"Yes. Did you think we picked her as your companion by accident?"
"You had to be protected,"
said Savine's father, baring the teeth he still had as he wheeled his chair towards her.
I made an arrangement with the only ones who could do it.
Savine stared from one parent to another.
You used me as bait? Me and my children.
We used ourselves as bait, said her mother. It had to be done, Savine, said her father.
God smiles on results, my scripture teacher would have said. Zuri shut the door behind her. Her dress hung singed and shredded, and the bandages beneath were spotted red. Savine had never seen her so much as undo a top button before, had always taken that for fitting modesty, but without even knowing it, the burners had stumbled on the truth. It was one of those moments, like the uprising in Valbec, like the battle at Stauffenbeck, when Savine was forced to realize the world was not quite what she had thought it was, when the solid foundations were revealed to be shifting sands, and all her certainties no more than guesses. She wanted to back away, wanted to run out into the hall and keep running, but she stood her ground.
Who was your scripture teacher? She croaked.
The prophet Kalul, said Zuri, stepping into the room. As you have no doubt guessed.
Her hair had come unpinned on one side, hanging across her bloody face, her bloody chin, her bloody throat in a black curtain.
I wish I could have told you sooner. Is your name even Zuri? I have had others, but I am Zuri now. I will be Zuri for as long as you need me.
You are my friend, whispered Savine.
She thought she might be crying.
My one real friend.
The slightest frown wrinkled Zuri's smooth brow as she came closer.
I still am, and you are mine.
You eat people,
and you grind them to dust in your mills, and render them to meat on your battlefields, and let them rot when the sickness sweeps through your slums.
I trusted you.
Zuri looked almost hurt by that.
And I have done my best never to let you down.
Because of some deal with my father?
At first.
Zuri flitted the last few strides towards her in a flash, a sudden chill breeze making Savine flinch. Zuri already had her hand in hers, so gentle but so strong, the black hair softly settling across her bloody face.
But soon I came to respect you, then to admire you, then to love you.
She reached up and delicately wiped a tear from Savine's cheek with her cool thumb tip.
I am very old, she said. I did not think I had anything to learn, but we have learned so much from you. Imagine a South and a Union not opposed, but bound together by trade and industry and common interest, not looking always into an ignorant and superstitious past, but fixed on progress.
Her black eyes shone at the thought.
A South and a Union where the people are governed not by the selfish whims of priests or wizards, but by the righteous engineering of the Watch and the Book.
What would your scripture teacher think of that?
Whispered Savine. It has been many years since I cared a shit for his opinions. And Zuri gave a little smile, like a lover venturing a joke so they could see if they were forgiven for some petty misdemeanor. By the fates, could Savine still hear the faint cracking of bone from the room next door? Her father, who had burned half the world so he could control the other half, put a hand on her wrist.
You need our advice.
Her mother, who had helped hatch the colossal scheme, put a hand on her shoulder.
You need our support.
Zuri smiled wider, her teeth still pink with sulfur's blood.
You need our protection.
They were not wrong. The world might not have been quite what she thought, but above all, Savine had always been a woman of business, and a woman of business must adapt quickly to new circumstances and recognize a bargain when she sees it. She had handled difficult partners before, after all, and come out ahead. She slid the box from her sleeve and took a healthy pinch of pearl dust up each nostril, then another, just to stop her hands from shaking. She wiped her nose carefully, dabbed her eyes on her unburned sleeve, pushed her chin up and her shoulders back, and managed something like a smile. "Well," she said, "no one ever achieved anything alone."